Hello, and welcome to An Intelligent Look at Terrorism. I'm your host, Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting in Ottawa, Canada. Today is Monday, April the 22nd, Earth Day, as we call it. And here I am, about to start a podcast on yet another horrific, heinous act of terrorism. This time in Sri Lanka. On Easter Sunday, during Easter Mass in many Catholic churches in Sri Lanka, there was a series of suicide bombers and explosions that took place on both coasts of the country, killing, as of last count, at least 290 people and wounding some 500 others. When I first heard of the attacks, early morning our time in Canada, mid-afternoon, I suppose, in Sri Lanka, I wasn't quite sure what to make of them. I've been following the attacks, or rather, extremist violence in Sri Lanka for some time now, in preparation for my forthcoming book, God Made Me Do It, How Violent Groups Use Religion to Justify Violence. And I was aware of a number of Buddhist extremist groups, of all things, that were carrying out attacks, intimidation against both Muslims and to a lesser extent against Christians. So my initial reaction was, I wonder if Buddhist extremists have gone to the nth degree and planned and carried out these vicious attacks against worshiping Christians on what is the holiest day in the Christian calendar, Easter Sunday. But as information has slowly eked out over the past 48 hours or so, it's looking more and more like this attack was in fact an Islamist extremist attack, and a particularly gruesome one. The death toll as it stands right now means that this particular series of attacks, and I believe there were at least 8 attacks on churches and hotels throughout Sri Lanka, as I mentioned, is one of the deadliest attacks in history, certainly the deadliest in Sri Lankan history. Sri Lanka is a country that has seen far too much violence in its post-colonial history. We're all aware of the Sri Lankan Civil War that lasted from 83 until 2009, a full quarter century, in which the government was trying to put down a movement that was seeking to establish an independent homeland for the Tamils, which constitute a minority in Sri Lanka. The Sinhalese are the majority. And in the course of this civil war, anywhere between 80 and 100,000 people died, and some estimates are that in the aftermath of the Civil War, when the Sinhalese army mopped up what was left in the northern part of Sri Lanka that had been ruled by the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, or LTTE, the Tamil Tigers for short, that a further as many as 100,000 people may have died. Figures are kind of a little bit wonky here. But Sri Lanka had been a relatively benign, non-violent place since the end of the Civil War in 2009, although, as I said, there were reports that some of the Sinhalese Buddhists were wreaking some kind of havoc against the Muslim population, which is only about 7% of Sri Lanka. I'd also add that, as I've said on many occasions in the past, that terrorist movements that do not address fully the grievance that leads them to form in the first place don't really disappear, or rather the ideology that underpins the movements doesn't go away. The Tamils didn't get their homeland. There's no independent state in northern Sri Lanka. And so I'd be very surprised if there are not still people on the ground in that country who would consider violence as a way to get what they want. However, in the attacks that took place yesterday on Easter Sunday, there seems, at least at this point, no question that the Tamil Tigers or other Tamil separatists slash extremists were in fact behind the attacks that left 300 people dead. What I find very interesting about the attacks in Sri Lanka, and I'm not trying to be dismissive or completely dispassionate when I say this, is how much we know and how much we don't know. The Sri Lankan government has said that it believes that a Muslim extremist group, as they described it, the National Tawheed Jamaat, was behind the attack. And this group was certainly a new one to me. I had never heard of it before. It appears to have been a group of Muslim fundamentalists, I could say, that had engaged in vandalization of Buddhist statues in the last couple of years. Certainly no terrorist attacks that I'm aware of. And yet, all of a sudden, this group was being blamed for at least eight, simultaneous bombings on both coasts of the country, which indicates an incredible degree of sophistication, an amazing amount of planning. And my first question was, how does a group go from taking a hammer to Buddha statues to recruiting and training and outfitting suicide bombers to carry out attacks on such a scale? I still don't know how they did that. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. It's still not clear to me. What is also interesting is that the Sri Lankan government has stated that there is some belief that, in part because this group was not known to be that sophisticated or that capable, that there is in fact an international angle to this. That I find fascinating. And my first question is, well, what is the international angle? Are we talking Al-Qaeda? There is an Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent group that's quite active in India and Pakistan. Were they behind that? Was it Islamic State? I'm not aware of an Islamic State affiliate in Sri Lanka, but Islamic State has affiliates around the world and certainly has people whom it inspires around the world. Was this somehow linked to the foreign fighter phenomenon? We know that the Maldives, which is not that far from Sri Lanka, has one of the highest per capita number of foreign fighters that fought for Islamic State from 2014 to 2018. Are some of those people involved? Or was it truly an indigenous movement within Sri Lanka that somehow got assistance from terrorist groups abroad? These are all very good questions, and none of them are answered as of 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Earth Day, April the 22nd. So I think we have to be very careful in drawing conclusions as to who was behind this attack. The other issue that has come to the fore in the past 24 hours is the fact that the Sri Lankan government is believed to have had some kind of intelligence a few days in advance that indicated an attack was coming. And so the question now is, what was done? Why was nothing taken care of? Why was the intelligence not passed? Why was it not acted on? Why was it not prevented? And as you can probably imagine, as somebody who worked in intelligence for as long as I have, I'm rather sensitive to issues of intelligence failures, so I'm not going to give in completely to that particular angle right now, but I will state that there has been some political infighting in Sri Lanka over the past couple of years, and that this infighting may in fact have led to the inability to pass on important intelligence that could in fact have been used to prevent this attack. The infighting has been between the president and the prime minister. There's some reporting that the prime minister was not given intelligence, has not been actually privy to intelligence briefs for the last little while. And if that's the case, that is completely unconscionable. Speaking as a Canadian, I know that there have been times where I felt that intelligence was not used properly, was not given enough credence. But for the Prime Minister to actually not be invited into intelligence briefings in the country, the guy that runs the government is not being informed as to what the threats are, strikes me as very, very wrong, unconscionable, unforgiving. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the days and weeks to come. As I said, Sri Lanka isn't the most stable of places right now. We have one prime minister trying to essentially place another one. And in the wake of an attack of this scale, I think a lot of fingers will be pointing a lot of different directions. So it'll be interesting to see if in fact Mr. Wickremesinghe, who's the current president, will be in fact sacked and be replaced by his predecessor, Mahinda Rajapaksa. So watch this space as well. I do find the selection of targets within Sri Lanka very curious, though. Sri Lanka's Christian population is not that large, approximately 7% from what I've read. Sri Lanka has not been on the top of my list of potential terrorist attacks for quite some time now, since the so-called defeat of the Tamil Tigers in 2009. And aside from some Buddhist extremism thuggery, I would call it, there have not been any major terrorist attacks for quite a number of years in that island nation. There have been reports that Islamic State may in fact be on the verge of claiming this attack. I did see one post on Twitter that said that Islamic State has photographs of at least three of the suicide bombers who have perhaps pledged allegiance to Islamic State or who were photographed with Islamic State flags. And that'll be a very interesting occurrence if it turns out to be the case. So the question would be if these men, in fact, were Islamic State, inspired by it, trained by it, sponsored by it, how was that contact made? Did they travel abroad? Were they, in fact, foreign fighters? Sri Lanka has somewhere around three dozen foreign fighters that fought with Islamic State, from what I've read. Are these guys returnees? People that gained experience in Iraq and Syria, who would have gained contacts, who would have gained training, who would have gained know-how? Again, we don't know that just yet. But the selection of Catholic churches in Sri Lanka makes sense at one level and makes no sense at another. So for the former, why it makes sense, we know that Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and any number of Islamist extremist groups have in fact been calling for attacks against Christian institutions for decades. We see Islamic State in the Sinai, the affiliate in Egypt, has been carrying on attacks against Egypt's Coptic Christians for years now, killed hundreds of Christians over the years, attacked churches. We've seen attacks on churches in other countries as well. So if this turns out to be an Islamist extremist attack, and again, right now we don't know for certain, but it certainly indicators are pointing in that direction. The choice of churches is a logical one. It fits a pattern, something we've seen in many countries over the last couple of years. So that part makes sense to me, as does the selection of hotels, because we know that hotels, especially luxury hotels, as these were in Sri Lanka, tend to be places where Westerners, foreigners congregate. And we know that Al-Qaeda and Islamic State and other groups like that do see Westerners as the enemy. They see them as the kuffar, as the infidels. They see them as representatives of their government, whom terrorists think we are at war with them, either through our invasions or military forces or alliances with governments they're trying to overthrow. So the choice of hotels as a target is a no-brainer as well. But getting back to the churches, something has me a little bit miffed, a little bit confused rather. Why would Christian churches in Sri Lanka be the target of Islamist extremists? As I noted, there have been attacks by Buddhist extremists on Sri Lanka's Muslims for quite some time now. Quite a lot of violence, actually, and this is a topic I cover to some extent in my forthcoming book on religious extremism. But I can think of a lot of other places that would be more lucrative targets for Islamist extremists to attack, not Sri Lanka. Secondly, if in fact it's Sri Lankan Buddhists that have been the thorn in the side of the country's Muslims for years now, why would not an Islamist extremist group attack a Buddhist temple or a place where Buddhists congregate? We know for a fact that extremist groups like Islamic State and others do call for revenge. They do call for retaliation. We saw that in the wake of the attacks in Christchurch, New Zealand, a month and a half ago, where groups said you have to avenge your Muslim brothers and sisters who were killed by a white supremacist in Christchurch, New Zealand. So if you're going to seek revenge and retaliation, wouldn't you seek revenge and retaliation against the people that were meting out violence against you? Wouldn't that be a more logical choice? Hence, I would submit that targeting Buddhist institutions would be a much greater retaliatory move than striking Christian churches. However, that's not what happened. The majority of the victims seem to have been Catholics, celebrating Easter Sunday Mass, and foreigners, as well as Sri Lankans, at the hotels. So again, I'm left with this quasi-conundrum that we have an Islamist extremist attack that took place in a country not known to be a hotbed of Islamist extremism, one that certainly has a history of terrorism, but not this type of terrorism. So it fits a pattern in one sense and destroys a pattern in the second sense. And I think there's an important lesson here. And the important lesson is, and I've stated this on many occasions in the past, terrorism can happen anywhere, anytime. Even if you weren't suspecting Sri Lanka to be a target, it has become a target. We now see that countries are warning their citizens against travel to Sri Lanka. I think that's a little bit of a stretch, unless there's intelligence to point to further attacks being planned. I would say Sri Lanka is any more or less dangerous than any other country in the world. But it's important to remind ourselves that even if terrorism can occur anywhere, anytime, it does not occur everywhere, every time. What I mean by that is that terrorism is still, with a few exceptions, a relatively rare phenomenon in most countries around the world. Yeah, not in Afghanistan or Nigeria or Somalia, but just about everywhere else, the chances of you dying in a terrorist attack in any given country on any given date are orders of magnitude less than dying from a lightning strike or drowning in your bathtub. So that's important to bear in mind. The other issue I want to return to is this notion of intelligence failure. It's been reported that intelligence was received by Sri Lanka. It is not certain if intelligence was indigenous, domestic intelligence. There were some reports that an international partner forwarded some information to the Sri Lankans. Who that partner is not clear at this point. It could be India, it could be the Americans, it could be the Brits, it could be the Germans, the French. I'm not sure which intelligence service, if any, provided intelligence to the Sri Lankan government. And I've already noted that it appears not to have been acted on, and that's leading to all kinds of questions as to why it wasn't. The more important issue to raise here, though, is what was the nature of that intelligence? From what I've read in open sources, it appears to have been particularly detailed, listing the threat, listing the targets, i.e. Catholic churches, and even listing some names of possible perpetrators. If that's the case, that's extremely rare. Based on my 32 years in intelligence, it is generally true that intelligence is piecemeal, it is fragmented, it is rarely definitive, and it does not allow you to determine with absolute certainty when something's going to happen and where it's going to happen. To cite a great analogy, you can look back to 9/11. We all know, based on what we've read, that in the summer preceding the attacks on September the 11th, 2001, that in the words of American intelligence officials, all the lights were blinking red. They knew something was up. Al-Qaeda was planning something. But my understanding of the intelligence at the time, and I did work for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service when 9/11 happened, was that the intelligence was something along the lines of, we're going to do something, somewhere, sometime. Now, what do you do with that? If you work for an intelligence service or a law enforcement agency, how does that help you deploy resources? Where do you put your people? Where do you put your armed response? Which buildings do you guard more closely than others? Which teams do you send out? What kind of cells do you infiltrate? What kinds of targets do you try to secure? Again, I don't know that the intelligence in this case was any more specific than what I'm used to. If it was, then that indeed is an intelligence failure. Is it tied to the fact that Prime Minister was not involved, or is it something else that's yet to be determined? And Sri Lanka will look into this. But if it was typical intelligence, then no, not necessarily is this a failure. You can't prevent what you're not sure is going to happen. You can have inklings, you can have strong indications, your sources may be telling you things, but unless you have a name, an address, a date, an actual target, you have intelligence on surveillance or some kind of intercepted communications that give you a lot of details, you're left basically trying to do what you can with the resources that you have. So again, I know I'm very sensitive to this issue because of my background, but I would like people to sort of just take a step back when they hear the word intelligence failure to ask really hard questions. What does that mean? Was it inevitable that this attack could have been prevented, given what they knew when they knew it? I'm not so sure of that. Maybe I'll be proven wrong in the days and weeks to come. I don't know. I guess we're going to see. I find myself in the same frame of mind as I was after the Christchurch attack of a month and a half ago now. Tremendous loss of life. Something I'm supposed to get used to after 32 years in intelligence and almost 20 years now working on terrorism. But I'm not. I find myself saddened. I find myself at a loss for what to say when 290 people have been killed. How many families have been ruined? I read about a Danish man who lost three of his children in one of the hotel attacks. That's not to take away from all the Sri Lankans that were killed, but I mean, his story is magnified probably a thousandfold with all the victims, either the dead or the wounded. I guess as a reminder, as one of my interviewees, when I did a bunch of interviews today, asked me, it reminds us just how much people hate. I suppose it does. Hate has been with us since we fell out of the trees millions of years ago. Luckily, most people don't take their hatred to the nth degree and kill people. In this case, obviously, some group did. Some set of individuals did. And I think we really struggle to understand how you can hate somebody that much. How can you hate a community? How can you hate a faith? How can you hate somebody who's different than you? Someone who dresses differently than you, or is of a different ethnicity, or a different language group, or a different religious affiliation. And yet, here we are again, as we have been far too often over the past couple of decades, talking about one more terrorist attack by one group of people that thought another group should die. It's depressing. It's again, I'm not sure where to go with this. We're going to see more. That's, I can tell you that. Sorry if that disturbs you. But again, to go to my earlier point, we're not going to see necessarily more everywhere all the time. And I think we have to take that message to heart. We can't lose hope that terrorism is going to take over. It's not. Groups will rise, groups will fall. We're seeing more far-right attacks now. There were still Islamist extremist attacks. I hate to beat this dead horse, but for those who said that the far right is more important than Islamist extremists, they're not. In fact, both are equally important. And it's incumbent upon us as societies and our security services and our law enforcement agencies to do as much as they can to prevent terrorism of any stripe. Right wing, left wing, religious, single issue, whatever. They're all a menace to our society. Thankfully, a rather limited menace, but we can't ignore them. That's the end of this podcast, podcast number 8. I do promise I will get to some more regular themes in the weeks to come, but these massive incidents like Christchurch and Sri Lanka keep coming to the fore, and I think I really should address them while they're rather recent on people's minds. As usual, you can get a hold of me via my email address, borealisrisk@gmail.com. You can leave comments on the YouTube podcast. Podcasts are also available on iTunes and several other platforms. You can reach me on LinkedIn, on Twitter, @BorealisSaves, or on Facebook. That's it for the 8th episode of An Intelligent Look at Terrorism. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, stay safe.